Welcome to season 25 of the Follow My Lead podcast, where each week I bring you stories and best practices of today's leaders to help you on your leadership journey. My name is John Eads. Here we go. Welcome back. Another week to learn and grow and develop and get better. And that's exactly what we're going to do in the midst of this uncertain time and the struggle that many of us are facing as it relates to work and at home and the coronavirus. And I'm joined by someone that I think will bring some light to your life. His name is Mike Robbins. He's the author of We're All In This Together, which is just a fantastic title right now. I had a wonderful discussion with Mike. I enjoyed it so much. I moved it right to today. I mean, this is just a great message. Mike shares a lesson at the very end of this episode that I think I'll remember forever. So I hope you'll stick around to the end to learn it as well. Powerful words that will absolutely help you on your journey. Before we get there, just I know how much is going on, and we've heard from so many of our listeners that this is part of their week that keeps them going, that keeps their mind growing and developing in all of this uncertainty. Some have even been furloughed and are looking for new jobs. My thoughts and prayers go out to each of you. All I can say is to continue to do the work each and every day. As this thing is going down and the struggle, there's opportunities to learn and grow and develop and come up with new ideas so you'll be better prepared for the way up. And the fact that you're listening to this today tells me you're all about that. So do not stop developing. We're right here with you. If there's anything we can do to help, don't hesitate to reach out. Now, my conversation with Mike is just loaded with gold, so I'm not going to hold you back anymore from it. So without further ado, here's my fantastic conversation with my friend, Mike Robbins, the author of We're All In This Together. Well, Mike, thanks for being on the show.
Hey, John, thanks for having me, man. Glad to be here.
Man, I'm really excited you're here. I first got to learn about you from one of your TED Talks about appreciation, and it just really stood out to me. Your background and how you got into this world, and then you kind of immersed yourself into this world of appreciation and the human element of business. Take my audience back to who Mike Robbins is and how you got to what you're doing today.
Well, I grew up in Oakland, California, in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I still live. I played baseball all as a kid, John, as you know, and was pretty passionate about it, was actually pretty good at it. I got drafted out of high school by the Yankees. Didn't end up signing with the Yankees because I got a chance to play baseball in college at Stanford, go to Stanford, and then get drafted out of Stanford by the Kansas City Royals. Signed a pro contract, as you do if you're lucky enough to get drafted. But when you sign a contract with a major league team, you have to go into the minor leagues. And I was working my way up trying to get through the minor leagues to get to the major leagues. I was a pitcher. Unfortunately for me, my third season still in the minors with Kansas City, I went out to pitch one night, threw one pitch, tore ligaments in my elbow, blew my arm out. Basically ended my career at 23. I didn't end completely at that point. I ended up spending the next 2 years having three surgeries on my arm trying to come back. But by the time I turned 25, I was forced to walk away from the game. And, as a former athlete yourself, you know, it's devastating. It's life-altering. It's disorienting when you do something for so long and are pretty good at it and then have to try to go do something else. But I learned a couple really important lessons from that experience. Personally, what I learned, John, was I spent most of my time all those years playing, thinking that I wasn't good enough, comparing myself to everyone around me and like holding my breath, hoping that I didn't screw it up. And when it finally ended in a different way than I wanted it to, and I was bummed, I was actually more bummed that I hadn't fully appreciated it. I was like, oops, I think I missed the point of this whole thing. And then collectively, or sort of on a team level, what I'd become fascinated by, particularly by the time I got to college and was playing professionally, is I was fascinated by the human dynamics that go into teams. You know, like I was on some teams where we had really good talent, but the team wasn't very good because like there were egos and guys didn't get along and we just couldn't figure out how to bring out the best in each other. And I was on some other teams where, you know, talent was decent, not great, and the team was fantastic. We would like beat other teams that had better players than we did. And, you know, in sports, team sports, we call that chemistry. No one knows what the heck it is, but you know when you have it and you know when you don't. I got into the business world when I came home. I get a job in the late 90s working in the dot-com world, and I figured the business world, the tech world would be super different than the sports world, and it was. But the thing I noticed right away was like, oh, that team chemistry thing, that's not a sports thing, right? you and I know this now, of course, it's a human thing. It's culture. But like, I was like, well, what is that? How do you create that? And so after working for a couple different internet companies in the 90s, I started my consulting business 20 years ago, basically with the question of how do you create the conditions necessary for teams to really thrive? I saw it as an athlete. It was more of the exception than the rule. I saw it a little bit in business. Again, more the exception than the rule. But there's something that great teams do that other teams don't. And I want to try to both figure that out. And then I want to try to teach it to other people so they can benefit from it. And that's basically been the mission that I've been on for the last 20 years.
Well, you probably should have written this current book first then, because it's all about team dynamics and teamwork. Before we get to the book, which I'm really excited about, we're all in this together. You know, I wanted you to touch on a little bit of that initial work that maybe, quote unquote, put you on the map, right? With, you know, the talk about appreciation and what it really means. And where I wanted to dig into today, just to make sure our audience kind of got that same value that I got when I first learned about you. You talked at deep length about the difference in being appreciated and being valued.
Yes.
And I don't want to put you on the spot, but, you know, and really digging into it, really the difference in recognition and appreciation, to be really clear on what that was. But maybe if you don't mind, just talk a little bit about recognition versus appreciation and how that kind of got you on the map.
Sure. Well, you know, one of the things that I started with in those early years of my business, John, was I was trying to, you know, unpack, you know, again, what makes a great team and what makes a great relationship and what motivates me and what motivates people. And I started to try to like look into that in my own experience, talk to people about that, research that. And what I kept coming back to was appreciation. Like every great coach I ever played for, every great team I was on, in my limited experience in the business world in my 20s after my baseball career ended, it was like teammates that I had or managers that I had, when I just thought about wanting this desire that I have, and I think most of us have, to be appreciated. But what I started to see was, in the context of whether it's sports or business or anything, even a family, there's a difference between being recognized for what we do, an outcome, and actually being appreciated for who we are. So then I started to unpack this really simple, but I think important distinction. Recognition, and both of these are important, by the way. Yep. For everybody listening to us, if you manage other people, if you work in a team, if you have anyone you're in relationship with in your life that matters to you, being able to recognize someone, that's thanking someone, that's saying, hey, good job, way to go. It can be informal. I can say, hey, John, that was awesome. You did a great job on that project, or thank you so much for whatever it is you did. I'm responding to what you did. Now, it can be more formal in the business setting. You can get an award, you can get a raise, you can get a promotion, you can get, right? There's lots of ways we get recognized. Appreciation, on the other hand, is about recognizing people's value inherently. It's more about who they are. So recognition is more about what we do. Appreciation is more about who we are. And the example that I often use, and in that TED Talk you mentioned, I share this example when I'm speaking about this, I often do. I use an example from my baseball career to really illustrate it. And this is one of the things I do not miss about playing baseball, specifically being a pitcher. Most people, even if you're not a baseball fan, you know what happens to the pitcher in the baseball game when the pitcher doesn't do well, right? They stop the game. The manager comes out to the mound, physically removes the ball from your hand, and makes you leave. And it's a pretty humiliating experience. I mean, maybe if it's like, it was late in the game, it's like the eighth inning, the game's closed, the bases are loaded, I'm getting tired, I threw a lot of pitches, that's okay. But still, I don't like to come out. But it was always the worst if it was like early in the game, it was the second inning, and I gave up a grand slam, and we're already losing 7-0. And right, I would walk off the pitcher's mound, I would go into the dugout where all my teammates were, right? And I would sit down, and nobody would talk to me. And it was terrible. That was the worst part of the whole experience, because I was sitting there, right? Like, and so again, in the context of recognition and appreciation, I didn't want or deserve any recognition in that moment. What are they going to say? Hey, Robbins, way to go. Great job, man. You gave up 7 runs in the second inning. Like, no, that I did a terrible job. So I personally failed. I failed for the team. That was not a good performance. I didn't want anyone to thank me or high five me or, you know, but what I needed in those moments and almost never got was some appreciation for me, the person. Like, hey, man, we got your back. You know, we believe in you. I mean, not blowing smoke, trying to make me feel better, but just genuinely connecting with me, even asking me like, how are you? Or do you need anything? Or some kind of, mostly, because again, what are they going to say? Yeah. They just left me alone. But again, in life, there's not always something to recognize. but there's always people to appreciate. And what makes great leaders and what makes great relationships and teams is a commitment to, we're going to appreciate and value each other all the time.
How do you distinct, or how can a leader think about, you know, certainly in the results-driven world that we live in business, it's easy to look for things to give recognition for, right? Yes. Something that somebody does.
Yeah, for sure.
And most of the best leaders that we've studied as well, they care about the human being inherently.
Yes.
So how can leaders think about showing true appreciation versus just giving them the award when they hit their quota? I mean, what are ways that leaders can actually show appreciation that they could be tangible and take back? Because there might not be a better time than right now than to show a true appreciation for the human being showing up for work.
Absolutely. I mean, in the midst of this crazy moment that we're in, that's probably going to last for a while, we don't know what it's all going to look like and where it's going to go. Appreciation is even more important, because there isn't necessarily going to be. Now, you can recognize people's effort. You can recognize people showing up and doing things. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. You know, but again, appreciating people is really about valuing them. One of the best things we can do to appreciate people, John, is to listen to them. Like, ask them how they're doing and actually mean it. Often we say, hey, how's it going? How you doing? And then you're supposed to say, I'm fine. How are you? Fine. We're not really asking that question. We're just saying hello in a friendly way to say hello, but we don't really mean it. Like, ask people, how are you? Or what's going on? Or how are you feeling? Or how's your family? And then listen to what they say without needing to fix it or change it or cheer them up or anything. It just give people space, right?
Have you been talking to my wife, Mike?
Well, look, it is something that stereotypically we're not very good at as men, because we're organized around producing results and solving problems. And, you know, not that there's anything wrong with either of those things, but sometimes in the stereotypical male-female relationship, right? Husband comes and says, you know, honey, how are you? And then she starts to tell you how she is. And immediately, well, have you thought about this? Or you should do that? Or why? Don't complain about this. And all of a sudden she's like, you're not listening to me. When really what she was mostly asking for is just hear me, value me, love me, create space for me, right? Years ago, my wife, Michelle, and I have been together for 20 years. We went to see a counselor who really helped us with a bunch of things. And he said to me, Mike, one of the best questions you can ask Michelle when she's upset and she's talking is, what else? What else? He said, I know you're going to get scared that it's just going to be a never ending, right? The irony is that I talk as much or more than my wife does, but that's beside the point. But he just said, keep saying what else, what else, what else, to get to the bottom of whatever it is she needs to say. And when you say what else and she says, that's it. And then my male brain was like, but I'm supposed to fix it. I'm supposed to be. And the therapist was like, no, your job is to just listen. And if she really wants your feedback or really wants your advice or really wants your guidance or something, she'll let you know. She'll tell you, what do you think about this? Or what should I do about this? But if she's just sharing her experience. Now, again, this isn't about a marriage necessarily, but at work, similarly, as managers, as leaders, part of our job is to check in with people and give them space to let us know how they're actually doing. Because if I work for you and you don't really know how I'm doing, you're going to have a hard time supporting me. Hmm. And if I don't feel safe to let you know how I'm doing, and I'm just, well, I'll tell you when I close the deal or when I have a result to produce that you can say good job for, like, that's going to create a dynamic in our relationship that doesn't have a ton of trust or depth. So just listening is one thing we can do. Another thing that we can do in terms of appreciating people is understand what motivates them. I say this to leaders all the time. Here's a great conversation to have with people on your team, even and especially right now in the midst of crisis, in the midst of stress and fear, is, hey, what can I do or say to motivate you best? Like, what fires you up? What gets you going? And at the same time, what can I do to really irritate you, annoy you, stress you out? Because the truth is, John, you're wired different than me, just like every single person on the team. And I need to try to understand, right? Think about this with our own children. You have two kids, I have two kids. They're wired differently, even though they came from the same parents. So how you motivate one kid is different than how you motivate another. What one kid needs, you know, you have a boy and a girl, I have two girls, but our two daughters couldn't be more different than two other humans I've ever met in my life, even though they share the same DNA and they look similar sometimes, but they act very differently. And the same is true for our teens, right? So getting to know people, what makes them tick. And then a third thing that we can do is proactively express appreciation for people, not based on something that they did, but inherent qualities that they have. So the difference is, if I tell you good job on that thing, that's nice. But I could just as easily say that was a bad job, right? But if I let you know, hey, John, you know, I really appreciate the way you think. Like, you had that idea yesterday about that thing and I'd never thought of it and it made me think different. It's like, I'm so grateful you're on the team because you bring a perspective that I never think about. Thank you so much. You said, I mean, that's different than me telling you good job. I mean, I'm basically saying I liked your idea, but I'm telling you the qualities that you have are valuable to me and to the team. Thank you. Keep bringing those. It's going to reinforce to you, hey, Mike values that. The team values that. This is helpful. I'm going to keep bringing that forward. You see, so that's absolutely a little different than just saying, you know, way to go and close the deal.
Yeah, and I think it's really important as you start looking as the entire team, a leader responsible for more than one person.
Right.
And that's exactly what many leaders are. They're responsible for everybody, not just the top salesperson or not just the star pitcher or whatever it may be.
Right.
It gets really important then to show appreciation for who they are. And and I love that example. And I wanted this gives us a nice segue into the book. We're all in this together because you wrote some words that really stood out to me early in it. And I want to highlight them because you said you've learned two things about teamwork. One is that we are all unique. And two, we are all way more alike than we are different.
Yeah.
And so dig into that a little bit for me because, you know, particularly in this current environment where before it felt like we had Republicans on one side and Democrats on the other. And now all of a sudden it's like, we don't have a choice but to work together. Right. And so talk about teams and why everybody's unique, but then we're more alike than we are different.
I mean, on the surface, it sounds a little crazy and paradoxical, right? Because the truth is, and in America, we love to pride ourselves on individualism and we all get to be ourselves and speak up and have our own opinions. And that's great. And I think, look, we know the data shows us, and I talk about this in the book, that the more diverse our teams are, you bring people together from different backgrounds and perspectives, that creates a dynamic that, if you utilize that well, can make you incredibly successful. You don't want everyone on your team all agreeing with each other and all having the same set of skills and the same ideas and the same beliefs. So I think we can all do an even better job of understanding and appreciating the differences that people have and all the different gifts and talents that people bring. And at the same time, the further down below the waterline we go on the iceberg, I use the iceberg metaphor a lot in my work, the more similar we become. So like, you know, John, you and I could have different religions and different political beliefs and grow up in a different place and different ages and different families and different even core values. But if the further down below that waterline we go on the iceberg about who we really are, what we really think, what really matters to us, it's going to get to a point where we're going to find a ton of common ground not so much necessarily in our experience, right? You might come from a family with 10 kids and I might be an only child and you might live in North Carolina and I might live in California, right? But we get down to that place where it's like, oh, you're a human being like I'm a human being. You get scared, I get scared. You get excited, I get it. You know, I mean, those things that are sort of core to like in dealing with a crisis, whether it's a crisis in our life personally or a global crisis like we're facing at the moment, it does kind of remind us of our common humanity and common connection. And what great teams are able to do is galvanize both around goals and, you know, vision and mission and values and what we believe in. But also when we go through something collectively together, it will bond us together. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things I learned in sports. And the thing about baseball, I mean, golf is the same way where there's a lot of failure, but you do it individually. Yeah. In baseball, there's a ton of failure and you do it together. So there's a lot of losing in baseball. The team that won the World Series last year, the Washington Nationals, they lost 69 games in the regular season. They lost another 5 games in the postseason. They lost 41% of their games and did not win the championship until game 7 of the World Series in Houston, when no one thought they were going to win that game or the series, and they did. That's a ton of losing together to ultimately be the champion. And so we got to learn collectively how we can both simultaneously, I can acknowledge our uniqueness and our difference, and at the same time, remember at the end of the day and deep down, we're way more alike than we are different. And that's really the core of not only human connection and trust, but think of any great team or group or family you've ever been a part of. Mm-hmm. There's that sense of where is all of our common ground as human beings.
It's a wonderful point. And you talked about the crisis right now, which has many teams working remotely, whether they like it or not. You know, this was kind of thrown at them for probably many leaders. They've been leading a team where they saw their team every single day, and now they haven't seen them in you know, 3 weeks, right. Except on video. So I want, you wrote something in the book about a Salesforce study, and it found that 86% of, they cited collaboration and communication for their workplace failure.
Yes.
And as you start to think about now, so many people listening to this are leading teams that are now remote. And the number one reason remote leaders struggle or people fail with remote work is because of collaboration and communication. So given the current environment, the question would be, what can leaders do to ensure that this doesn't happen to their team before we get into these four pillars?
Well, I think, look, there are a bunch of businesses, like a lot of the companies we work with in Silicon Valley and other places, where remote working and virtual working has been happening. I mean, this is not a new phenomenon, right? Mm-hmm. You and I are connecting here over Zoom on video and on audio, and this technology continues to get better and better, and so we use it. The difference right now is that everyone is being forced to work remotely, and every leader is now managing a complete remote team, as opposed to maybe, oh, I have a couple people in different offices or in different regions or whatever, or oh, I'm the person that's usually isolated and remote, and we've learned strategies and tactics. So the first thing that's important for every leader and team to understand is we're in unique and difficult circumstances right now. Not as an excuse, not to whine about it, but just to acknowledge this is different, this is hard. Not to mention, most of us have our kids at home. If we have kids, they're trying to, you know, do distance learning. I mean, and we don't know what's happening. So there's an enormous amount of stress that's coming at us from every angle right now that's important just to acknowledge for ourselves and be mindful of as a leader. The second thing is, when I talk to leaders in general prior to the coronavirus in this situation who say, how do I create that sense of collaboration and team unity when not everyone's necessarily in the same room, or I have a couple people I manage who are in a different office? My response is, first of all, it varies, just like managing every individual on your team is going to vary. But second of all, you have to double down, triple down, quadruple down on whatever practices you have for connecting with people if you don't get to see them on a daily basis. So the truth of the matter is every leader's job right today has gotten a lot more complicated and a lot harder. It's not that we can't handle it. We're just going to have to flex a bunch of muscles we're not used to flexing and be willing to pivot and change on the fly. Because again, nobody really knows what they're doing right now. And I don't say that as an excuse or as a criticism. It's just we're in uncharted waters. And the best leaders that I'm working with and we're working with, you're probably seeing this too, John, are the ones that are being open and honest and real about what's going on, but also being the first to admit, I don't really know what I'm doing. Like, I'm doing the best I can. Let me show up and be the best leader I possibly can be. But they're open to feedback from their teams. Like, what can I start doing that I'm not doing? What can I stop doing that I'm doing that's problematic? And what can I continue doing? Like, constantly eliciting feedback from the team and giving feedback to the team, because we're all in this situation together and we're trying to navigate it as best we can.
Yeah. It's like putting their guard down. It should have already been down, but if you can't put it down right now and you act like you have all the answers, no one would ever believe you, because no one ever does, but they particularly don't as we speak right now.
When I think a good example, I've been using this example in the last few weeks. I heard someone say it and it resonated with me, is like, think of yourself, if you're a leader, like an airline pilot. And when you fly, John, you fly a lot like I do, right?
Sure.
I don't love when there's turbulence, but when turbulence is about to happen, when the pilot comes on and says, ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain speaking, we're about to hit some bumps. We're going to have the flight attendants take a seat and we're going to discontinue service because this is going to probably last. They usually tell us what's happening, when it's going to happen and for how long, they think, and they prepare us for it. So the bumps come. And even if they're significant, it's like, well, he told me, I know this is coming. I feel safe in that situation because he's in charge. He told me the bumps were coming. He took care of everyone around. When the bumps come and they don't say anything and it catches everyone off guard and the flight attendant goes flying and drinks go flying, it's super scary. And if the pilot doesn't come on and acknowledge it, at least in the moment or after the fact, in a very real way, I'm so sorry, we hit some bumps, we didn't see those coming, whatever. If they don't say anything, or they do come on and they try to sugarcoat, oh, no big deal, it's no problem, don't worry about it. But now I'm more stressed out because I'm like, was he paying attention? Did he fall asleep? Was he reading a book? What the hell's going on up there, right? So we want to be more like that first pilot. Hey, this is bumpy, this is scary. I can't guarantee how long it's going to last, but here's what I think. And here's what I'm doing, and here's what we're going to do. But just know, buckle in, this might get a little bumpy here, right? And that actually, even though it's not necessarily reassuring per se, it is, because it's like, okay, he or she is acknowledging the bumps that we're facing. And they're not just doing happy talk to try to make it all go away when it's not going to go away anytime soon.
It's a great, it's a great analogy. And I think it's someone, everybody is in this crisis together right now. Right. You know, it's very real for anybody to say which flight, which pilot they would prefer to be on a plane that they're going to have turbulence with.
Yes.
And so I appreciate that. You have four pillars in the book. We're not going to go through all of them. We're going to go through one. The first pillar is to create psychological safety.
Yep.
The second pillar is to focus on inclusion and belonging. Mm-hmm. The third pillar is to embrace sweaty palm conversations. And the last pillar is to care about and challenge each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the one I want to get into is to create psychological safety.
Yeah.
Mainly because right now, you know, you talk at length in this chapter about the difference in self-righteous and conviction.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to dig into what is psychological safety. You mentioned it's a little bit different than trust.
Yeah.
Speak to psychological safety and why it's so important, particularly in this current environment.
Well, psychological safety, the way I like to think about psychological safety is it's basically group trust. So individual trust, like you and I, John, can have trust of each other. You trust me, I trust you, or we don't for whatever reason, right?
Right,
you,
right.
If I lie to
you're
you,
bald,
or
you're a bald guy.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, whatever it is, we can have it, we don't, whatever right. The case may be. Psychological safety is that the group feels like there's safety and trust in the group, meaning you and I, we're all part of a team, and I know I can speak up, I can disagree, I can make a mistake, I can be different, I can have a dissenting opinion. I'm not going to get shamed, judged, ridiculed, sort of metaphorically kicked out of the group or have some retribution held against me for just, right? And we all know what it's like to be a part of a group where we feel that sense of safety and when we mm-hmm. don't, right? And why this is so important is Google did a study a few years ago that people listening may have read about or heard about called Project Aristotle. And what they did is they spent 3 years studying what are the necessary conditions for teams to create high performance. Like, what does a team need to have so that it can perform at the highest level? And what they found was that it was actually less about the individuals on the team and more about the dynamic that was created, right? It's that culture. It's that chemistry we've been talking about. But the number one, by far, most important condition they found after studying this for 3 years and looking at all kinds of data and research on this was psychological safety. Meaning that if a team has psychological safety, it's got a chance to perform well. If it doesn't, it's very, very difficult. When I talked to Karen May, who at the time was the head of learning and development at Google, and I asked her about this, I said, were you surprised by any of the findings of the study? And she said, you know, we weren't surprised that psychological safety was important. What we were surprised by was how important it was, that it basically was either a starter or non-starter for a team. And so when you think about this, everyone listening, when you think about it in terms of your team, what it means, and if you're a leader, do you create the environment where people can take risks, where people can speak up, where people can challenge you even, where we can talk about the things that need to be talked about in an open way, and people know their opinions are going to be heard and valued. Not always, I'm going to agree with you and take your advice and go do that thing, but you know you can speak up, you can try something and even fail, and you're not, again, going to get shamed or ridiculed. And so the reason why this is the first pillar in the book is for us to create a culture of high performance, of trust and belonging, and really do the kind of work that we want to, we have to start with psychological safety and we have to really commit to it.
You touch on it a little bit about, you know, one-on-one trust versus the collective of mm-hmm. psychological safety. And I think many leaders at their core can be like, Mike, I completely agree with you. Okay. Mm-hmm. I know if my team can't share their ideas, I know if my team can't be themselves or they're being some different version of themselves, we're not going to get to where we could get if everybody could.
Yep.
I don't think anybody at this point in time would disagree with any of that.
Right.
The part where most leaders struggle is to say, how do I do that? And particularly, how do I do that when I have a remote team?
Yeah.
You know, how do I create this team environment that you're talking about in psychological safety when at best we get together as a group once a week? And some weeks I even cancel that because I'm too busy.
Right.
So how do I do it?
Well, part of it is, look, and I know everyone's busy right now and in general. We never have time or enough time mm-hmm. to meet and connect as a team. Like, I'll just give you an example from my own team for what it's worth. We're literally meeting every day right now, even if it's just for 15 or 20 minutes, just to connect. And mostly the conversation is, how are you doing? Like, really, how are you doing? And we just, I start usually and just share how I'm actually doing, like yeah. as a human, not as the boss and the person in charge. And usually it starts with some version of, I'm feeling excited and scared and angry and like confused and like a million other things. That's a lot, because that's genuinely what's going on for me. And I'm not doing that to scare them or freak them out, but to let them know it's okay. And then giving everyone else space to just share how they're actually experiencing this whole thing right now. Now, again, we're in a unique circumstance at the moment. I'm not normally meeting with my team every single day on Zoom. But I personally feel like it's super important for us to stay engaged and connected with each other as human beings, so we know how to support each other through this experience. First and foremost, as people, secondarily, as members of a team that are trying to create and do certain work together. Mm-hmm. And we have a ton of deadlines right now. We have a ton of things going on that we're pivoting and, you know, like you, events getting canceled and yeah. changed and a book coming out and all kinds of stuff. So I think what's important is for leaders to model that behavior. What did Gandhi teach us, right? Be the change. You want people to be open and transparent? Be open and transparent first. You want people to really tell the truth about what's going on? Tell the truth about what's going on. You want people to speak up when they need some help? You ask for help, right? I mean, if you model it, I say all the time to leaders, look, if you don't operate with authenticity and even with vulnerability, as scary as that can be, it's not impossible that your team, you know, for your team to do it. It just makes it 10 times harder. Right, John, if you're my boss and you never tell me that you ever get nervous or you make a mistake or you get upset about, you know, I don't ever see you as a human. I just see you as like, John's like, he's always confident and he's like a business robot. Like, I don't know how he does it, but right. Like, I'm going to think I have to be that way, or I can't ever come to you and say, man, like, I had a fight with my wife and my kid's upset or sick, or I don't know what I'm doing, or I screwed this thing up, because I'm going to think, well, that's not acceptable. Right. And so again, so much of strong leadership is not only, again, telling, hey, there's bumps ahead and I, you know, but it's also being willing to share some of our own humanity. And I think right now more than ever, oh, well, is it more challenging on, you know, Skype or Zoom? Absolutely. But, you know, I've been loving a lot of meetings I've been having with clients and people. I'm sure you've had the same, where I'm like talking to the CEO of a company and like the dog's barking in the background, or someone's got like a 4-year-old sitting on their lap and they're just, hey, we're trying to figure it out, or yeah, I don't know what's happening, or the dog just barfed, or you know what I mean? And you're like, yeah. That's like real life stuff that we're all trying to figure out. And in some ways it's forcing us even more to be that much more vulnerable, that much more human with each other. And even though that can be uncomfortable, I actually think the net of that is really positive. And then the challenge is going to be, can we maintain that level of humanity and openness as we move through this experience and life gets back to quote unquote more normal?
Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to ask you this, but just hearing that answer, which I'm drawn to, I think you have an interesting perspective on this. You know, there's been a lot of people that say, we don't need managers. We don't need leaders of teams. We can have, you know, we can cut out the manager. And you might see some of that in the coming mm-hmm. Months and years as the workforce is reduced in certain organizations that just can't sustain it.
Right.
You know, there's a chance they look for higher paying people and they look to cut.
Right.
What happens to a leaderless team?
You know, look, I mean, there are some places, and there's people like Tony Hsieh at Zappos and other places that have been very progressive about getting rid of hierarchy and managers. And, you know, I got to say, in theory, I think it sounds fantastic, mm-hmm. like disrupting the way we do things and not having it necessarily be a hierarchical, you know, top-down thing. I think that all sounds great. In practice, my personal experience and what I've seen over the years, I'm sure you've seen the same thing, John, working inside of organizations, is that strong leaders are fundamental to everything, right? I mean, there's the saying, like, people don't quit their job. They quit what? Their boss. Mm-hmm. So like bad leaders and bad managers are problematic. I remember talking to Stuart Crabb a few years ago. Now, Stu has since left. He was at Facebook in the early days when Facebook was really growing, before they ran into a lot of the issues and challenges they faced in the last few years. But they were literally like the hottest place to work in Silicon Valley for a couple of years. Everybody, people were leaving Google and leaving everywhere to go work for Facebook because that was like the place to be. And what Stu said, he was running learning at Facebook at the time. And there were people in that time, even as they were growing and everyone wanted to work there, there were people that would leave. And they would do exit interviews like every company does. Like, why'd you leave? Why are you taking off? You know, did you get a better opportunity? What did we do wrong? What could we do different? Because we want to keep our best people and whatnot. And he said what became abundantly clear to him, and he'd kind of already known this, but here he's like, here I was working at literally one of the hottest companies on the planet. And what I've learned in those exit interviews was that manager trumps brand every time. It doesn't matter how cool of a, he's like, and we had like a cool brand and a hot place and the, and a great place to work and all the benefits and you name it, and the massage thing and the free food and all the stuff, right? Flexible work, you can work, all that. But if you had a manager that you did not like and didn't resonate with and didn't work for you, I'm out of here. And on the flip side though, people will stay longer and engage more and work harder and go to that next level if they really feel a personal connection. Because whether the company has 5 people, 50 people, or 50,000, who we work with on a regular basis is our manager and our direct team. So that's a long answer to your question. Is it possible to have a leaderless team? Maybe. I just think it makes it difficult in the way that we've all worked for so long, not having that human being that we can trust and count on and look to for guidance, for support, for some sense of direction on where we're headed. Now, again, it's a blessing and a curse, because I think, right, again, if you have a bunch of bad leaders, yeah, probably better to get rid of them and just have a bunch of leaderless teams. But if you have some good ones, I think they're going to exponentially impact the business in a positive way.
It made me
think
of that. It made me think of the pilot example, mm-hmm, right? Without him or her coming over the intercom and saying, we're about to hit some turbulence,
right,
that team starts hitting turbulence with no one in the pilot seat saying, what's happening? You know, it's like pandemonium could have taken over. So it's a good example, I think.
You could have a robot flying the plane, and it's possible we will get to a point in life that could be the case. I don't know personally, though, even with all of human error and knowing that the robot statistically would probably be safer than a human up there, in the midst of a crisis, in the midst of a storm, in the midst of turbulence, I want a human, even though I don't know that human and I have no relationship to that human up there, I want a human being that can come on the intercom and say, here's what's happening,
yeah,
and tell me, yeah, human to human. And so that's where I really think leadership is so fundamental in so many ways, but never is it more important than in the midst of a crisis.
It's awesome stuff. Let's end on some fun stuff while we're at it.
Yes.
Who's someone in your life that you should give more credit to that you haven't?
Someone in my life that I should give more credit to than I haven't. You know, honestly, as you just said that, I think both of my daughters, and especially my older daughter, I think I'm struggling a bit these days being the father of a teenage daughter and trying to manage. My wife and I both struggle with the discipline and the boundaries, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. And this was back when they were toddlers and even now. And so I think there's a way in which, you know, she's very much like me in the stubbornness and pushes and pushes and pushes. And so I think I could give her some more credit and let her know I'm so proud of her. And she's such a strong, amazing young woman. And I'm also trying to find my muscle, if you will, around how do I really hold clear boundaries for her as she's becoming a teenager. And, you know, it's still, I'm doing the best I can and I'm screwing it up all the time.
Isn't that amazing that I'm so appreciative that you shared that, because it's ironic that you're in your field and I'm in a similar field. And
yes,
you know, you teach about appreciation and
right,
you know, you need to do it more with your daughter. And then you have to have these sweaty palm conversations more with her too. And you're writing books about it. And it's ironic, I think, for any of us. It shows you how hard it is.
Yes. And I think the closer, you know, look, over the years, Michelle and I have a great relationship, but over the years, I can't tell you how many times. I mean, I wrote my book on appreciation in 2007. I've been talking about appreciation for years. She'll look at me and say, hey, Mr. Appreciation, how about some appreciation for me, huh? And I'm like, oh, what? I'm not supposed to just give speeches about it and write books about it. I actually have to do it. Are you kidding? You know?
Oh, that's great. What's harder, leading at work or leading at home? Just around the same topic.
I think they're both hard for different reasons. I mean, I think leading at work is hard because of a lot of the dynamics and the money that's at stake in people's livelihoods, and that we don't have the same. I mean, if you're the CEO all the way down, you've got pressure and expectation, but there's so many competing demands. I think leading at home is hard to the point you and I were just talking about, that it's easy to talk about things. And when we're given a certain role, like people are supposed to pay attention to us at work, and at home, you know, a lot of those things change. I mean, again, I jokingly will say sometimes to my girls, especially when they're rolling their eyes at me, I'm like, you know, people actually pay your dad and listen to him talk. And they're like, yeah, dad, whatever. My little one said to me one day, you're only inspiring when they pay you, dad. And I'm like, what? What are you talking about?
Wake up inspiring.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's humbling because the other thing is at home, everything comes up. Right. It's all of it. And so it's all of the light side and all of the dark side. And we have to sort of navigate that as best as we can, which isn't always easy.
You get to leave our audience with one bit of advice today. What is that bit of advice?
You know, I've been thinking about this recently with everything that's going on. I had a conversation with a friend of mine a number of years ago, and I was going through a really difficult time personally. And he said something to me that was simple but profound. And I've been thinking about this conversation recently because I think it relates to all of us. And he said to me, Mike, even though it doesn't seem like it right now, I know you're in a tough spot. You have more than this requires. And I said, what do you mean? He said, you have more strength, more resilience within you than this moment requires, even though it might not feel like that to you because it seems overwhelming and you're in a pretty tough spot. I think for all of us right now, is this hard? Yes. Do we know where it's going? No. Is it going to impact some of us more significantly than others on the health side, on the financial side, absolutely. But what I do know to be true about myself, about you, about everybody listening, is that we are way stronger than we often give ourselves credit for. And if we can remember that and we can remind the people around us in a genuine way, we will get through this thing.
Beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. Where can people find about the book? We're All in This Together, creating a team culture of high performance, trust, and belonging. Where can people find out more about it, get it? And then certainly, where can people find out more about your work?
Yeah, the best place to do that, we actually set up a special page on our site. It's at mike-robbins.com/together. You can find out all about the book and my work. And if you get the book on that page, there's some free bonus material, some audios, some action guides that we put together that are augments or sort of support the book, and you can get those there.
Give it to us one more time. Make sure.
Mike-Robbins, robbins.com/together.
Okay. Awesome. And they can look for it online as too, wherever they're going to get their books. Eventually, we know that it's a storm right now, but
it might take a little while just because the supply chain is a little slow on non-essential things like books, but you can find it if you look for it.
All right, good. We're All in This Together. Mike Robbins, thank you so much for making time to come on the show.
Thanks for having me.